This week on Straight Talk Africa, the war in the Middle East is intensifying. 1 year after Israel invaded Gaza to eliminate Hamas, now it's attacking Lebanon to contain Hezbollah. Israel is responding to a brutal attack by Hamas on its citizens on October 7th, 2023, where 1,200 men, women and children were killed and over 200 were taken hostage. Repeated efforts by multiple parties to negotiate a ceasefire have failed. What will it take for the fighting to end? Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm your host, Vincent McCorry. The Israel-Hamas war has expanded into Lebanon and many fear that it will soon engulf the entire Middle East region. Meanwhile, the death toll from Palestinians is escalating. Gaza's Ministry of Health says more than 41,000 have been killed by Israeli attacks. A large number of them identified, the identified victims are women and children. Israel has issued an evacuation order for Palestinians in northern Gaza, including organizations providing humanitarian aid. Let's go to Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for the latest on this war. So, Linda, we've heard what Israel has said, asking people to evacuate, but at the same time, we see there's a letter that has been written from Washington to say, hey, allow more humanitarian aid. What's the word in Jerusalem?
Well, this is a pretty serious issue because it shows that, you know, pretty deep tensions between Israel and the United States. The letter was to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. And they basically gave Israel 30 days to respond to the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza and demanded that Israel allow 350 trucks of humanitarian aid into the Strip every day. And if not, the U.S. threatened to curb the weapons supply to Israel. That deadline falls just days after the U.S. election. Israel announced today that it had already allowed 50 trucks into northern Gaza with food and medicine.
All right. So that is an indication that it will actually heed this call from the U.S. so far?
Well, you know, Israel had been allowing a lot of aid into Gaza. The issue is that some of the aid is stolen by Hamas. And the other problem was that the UN was not able to safely distribute the aid. So Israel says that once it checks the aid to make sure there are no guns or weapons or any other thing in it, it has no problem with allowing needed aid into Gaza. It says its war is not against the people of Gaza. It's not trying to starve the people from Gaza, but that it has to make sure that the aid will not be stolen by Hamas and then used to, you know, fuel the war against Israel.
And yeah, I'm sure the U.S., by the time they wrote that letter, they must have really looked at all the angles. But here's a question, as the war now seems to be expanding, what are concerns in Israel from Israelis over a prospect of a long-drawn war and even a wider war?
So there's definitely concern about what might happen with Iran. Israel and Iran have already sort of traded, Israel assassinated two senior officials, one Hamas official in Tehran, although Israel hasn't taken responsibility. And then Iran fired some 200 missiles at Israel, and Israel now says that it has chosen targets that it will retaliate against. And Iran has said that if Israel retaliates, its response will be even harsher. So there's definitely a war of words. The war in Gaza has been going on now for over a year. There were a few times where they seemed very close to a ceasefire, and then it kind of broke down. There's still 101 Israeli hostages being held in Gaza, although at best half of them are still alive. And now Israel's involved in a ground operation in Lebanon. I wouldn't exactly call it a war yet. It's mostly in South Lebanon. And I think there things are a little different because Israel has wants people to be able to go back to their homes. There are 63,000 people from northern Israel who were evacuated at the beginning of the war and can't go back home. And once Israel went into South Lebanon, it found much more infrastructure and weapons, much more than it had, and tunnels than it had expected. And apparently Hezbollah was preparing an attack on Israel, similar to Hamas's attack on October 7th.
Now, inside Israel, we have seen protests from civilians criticizing the Prime Minister Netanyahu's government. The war has gone on for a year. Some people thought it was going to be just perhaps a few months. And then there are members of, those who are taken hostage and not home yet. What do the people, those who protest, want to see done differently by Prime Minister Netanyahu's government?
Well, the protesters say that there should be a new election in Israel, that Netanyahu does not have legitimacy to rule, and that basically everybody who allowed the failure of what happened on October 7th, which is the largest intelligence failure in Israel's history, how did they not know that Hamas would send 3,000 people across the border into Israel and actually take over several dozen communities for a couple of days? Some 1,200 people were killed, mostly civilians. So there are a lot of people who say anyone involved should have resigned, and they want new elections in Israel. Unlike many in the military establishment, including the chief of staff, the prime minister has not accepted responsibility, has not apologized for what happened, and says that, when you're in the middle of a war is not a time to even try to figure out what went wrong. You have to fight the war. So I think they want new elections. And barring that, they want Israel to agree to a ceasefire, which has been on the table for months, in which Israel would withdraw completely from Gaza, would free thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Palestinian prisoners, including hundreds of murderers, and would then get back the hostages, both the living and the dead. And the hostage families feel that they've been abandoned.
Yeah, I really know the U.S. has really been pushing for that ceasefire. Thank you very much, Linda, for that report. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will continue to attack Hezbollah without mercy everywhere in Lebanon, including Beirut. Right now, there is an evacuation order for the southern part of the country. For more on that, let's go to Patricia Korda in Beirut. Patricia, what's the latest from Beirut?
The latest is that the Israeli army is shelling again the southern part of the southern suburb of the city is the threshold of Hezbollah. During 5 days, they stopped. Now, again, they are targeting the weapon warehouses. In the south, the incursion of the Israeli army is very targeted against villages on the border where they say they have found tunnels. And also in the Bekaa Valley, the shelling has continued since 3 weeks. It's continuing. They are targeting as well Hezbollah, whether it is militiamen or military targets like warehouses and weapons. The casualties in Lebanon, of course, there is a lot of casualties. Among them, plenty of people from Hezbollah, but also there is collateral damage. Today, we are at around 2,000 people who are dead and more than 12,000 people injured. So this is the situation. It is continuing since the pager. It started with the pagers in mid-September, and now the strikes of the Israelis on Lebanon continue.
Now, of course, there are concerns that this war could expand. Israel says it will not stop until it neutralizes its enemies there. What are people saying? What is the concern there in Lebanon?
There are different Lebanon. There are so many Lebanon inside Lebanon. So what is being shelled is the Bekaa Valley, South Lebanon, the southern suburb, and sometimes some areas that are targeted in Mount Lebanon. The population is different. Lebanon is different communities. It's a melting pot of people. So you have in some areas that life is continuing normally. But there are economic. We are expecting. We waited. We thought that it would be a strike of a war of 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and now we are on the fourth week. It would be like a month soon. We are afraid for the economic situation. We have a lot, many displaced. We have 1,200,000 people who are displaced from South Lebanon and the southern suburbs. They are in Beirut. They are in Mount Lebanon. Winter will start soon. They are in schools, but also they are on pavements and public gardens and all this. And we know that the Lebanese government is, since 5 years, we are facing an economic crisis. So we are afraid of what will happen economically. And also some people are afraid of a general war against Lebanon, like in 2006. But I think it will not be the case if we listen to what the Israelis are saying and if we see how much targeted are the strikes of the Israelis on the Bekaa Valley, on southern Lebanon, and on the southern suburbs.
And very quickly, there are some who may not understand what's the beef between Israel and Hezbollah, and how has this impacted the local politics in Lebanon. Can you just elucidate on that just a little?
Yes, we have to make a difference between Lebanon and the Lebanese government and Hezbollah. Hezbollah was created by the Iranians 42 years ago, and Hezbollah is known by the Americans to have targeted the American embassy and the Marines in 1983 by suicide attacks. So what happened with time passing by, especially for the last 20 years, is Hezbollah grew bigger and bigger and took over Lebanese politics. So they have ministers in the government, they have deputies. Some Lebanese people say that Hezbollah is responsible of the killing of Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, of many leaders in Lebanon. Hezbollah is tied to Iran. It is the presence of Iran in the Mediterranean, on the Mediterranean Sea. So, but in the meantime, they got very important. They took over politics in Lebanon. They became also not only, it is considered by the UK, by the United States as a terrorist organization, but in Lebanon they are politically present, and they took over, they neutralized and they took over the politics in Lebanon, the political life in Lebanon, the administration and all this. So the decision that is being made, the Lebanese government is not the one who will take the decision for the 1701 or for the ceasefire and for all this. It has been like this for the last past year. Now, what? With this war, the Lebanese government is saying it is like distancing itself from Hezbollah because at some point we need a ceasefire. We need that the UN resolution be implemented so we live calmly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Patricia, for that report. And stay safe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, as the war is expanding and death toll is escalating, Israel is starting to lose support from the European Union and from the African continent. For more insight to this rapidly evolving situation, let's bring in our guests. Here in studio, we're joined by Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And from Cape Town, South Africa, we're joined by Sanusha Naidu, a senior research associate with the Institute for Global Dialogue. Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you.
Welcome to Straight
Talk
Africa.
Thank you very much.
Now, first, let me just start with South Africa. Sanusha, you're all the way there in the southern tip of the continent. How is this situation in the Middle East being viewed in terms of the long term? Because we've already witnessed a year of brutal fighting in Gaza. Now we're seeing the expansion to Lebanon. But looking forward, what is the pulse? I mean, right from where you are.
Good day, Vincent, and good day to the colleague in studio. I think it depends from which lens you're asking that question. If you look at it from the government perspective, and you know South Africa has been very active as on the ICJ and the case against Israel and the genocide, etc. I think on that basis, South Africa still projects that it's a two-state solution in terms of the crisis. The ceasefire is very much part of that, but they still talk about the fact that what's going on in Palestine, Gaza, and of course, I think the question now in terms of the extension to Lebanon comes back to the question of how are the international humanitarian law being applied, the rules of what we are seeing in terms of the international system and how that needs to basically find its traction. So that from the government perspective. I think when it comes to more kind of societal and public opinion, what you begin to see is perhaps divided narratives. You see people that kind of have a different perspective in terms of whether or not there can be a kind of ceasefire or an end to this protracted nature of the conflict. Some actually see it as, you know, how does this go forward? Is it going to find its way into whether the agency of international institutions that underpin international law and global governance, are they still capable and fit for purpose? And then, of course, on the other hand, you have those that kind of also get caught up in the kind of divides of what is the global narrative around how this has been seen in terms of the impact this is having on the people on the ground, the civilian and the humanitarian crisis, and of course how the protagonist in this war is being, or in this conflict, is being interpreted in terms of the interpretation of Israel, and of course looking at how this is being carried out in the context of the impact of Palestine. So it does find different narratives, and it gets polarized in many ways.
Yes. Now, Hussein, you know, a lot has been said about the war. People have taken sides. Others are confused. Others are in between. But war is ugly. Yeah. I don't think there's anybody who really likes to see war go on and on.
Very few.
From what you've been watching, from your assessment, knowing the mindset of, let's say, the Hamas and Iran, and then we know the mindset of Israel, what do you think would be the best approach to actually bringing this to an end?
Okay. So I think first thing is, especially when you talk about end games and off-ramps, from further escalation, you have to separate the Gaza war and the Lebanon war. Uh-huh. They are not the same war. They have evolved in parallel. They have fed off of each other. They are connected. They might even be Siamese twins, but they're conjoined. But they are not, you know, the same exact creature. In Gaza, I believe there's no real path at the moment to an end to the fighting and a ceasefire. Because even though you begin by saying nobody really likes war, in fact, there are small groups of people in power who do like war. Prime Minister Netanyahu and the coterie around him are absolutely really benefiting politically, personally, and they believe strategically.
But they will tell you they're reacting to what happened on October 7th.
Yeah, exactly. Of course.
And also fighting for the survival of Israel.
They say that. To me, it seems... that while you might be able to easily justify a military response, this is by any measure overkill, and also that Israel has fallen into a quagmire in Gaza where they cannot get out. The war is no longer the war they started, where they go from north to south, destroying everything of value to Hamas and to Gaza society in general. Now they're fighting an insurgency from which there is no end. The other group of people that are for continuing the war are the Hamas leaders. As you said, they attacked Israel on October 7th, and I think they wanted to provoke a permanent state of war with Israel. That's what they say. And that they want the insurgency as part of a long-term plan to gain credibility among Palestinians in their founding mission to take over the Palestinian national movement from the secular nationalists in the PLO and turn the Palestinian cause into an Islamist one led by them. They want to wave the bloody shirt. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to Lebanon, there is an off-ramp, which is the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701, as your correspondent was saying, which would involve Israel withdrawing from Lebanon, Hezbollah removing itself 25 kilometers north into away from the border to the Litani River, and the Lebanese military and UNIFIL, the UN security observers, going into the south, and that would be the off-ramp.
And we'll continue that conversation. Yeah. But it's time for a short break right now. And when we return, we'll continue our discussion on the fighting in the Middle East. Stay with us.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
In the digital age, and parents across the world are dealing with the challenge of trying to manage screen time and to understand the content of their children's digital engagement. Even worse, some parents' use of technology is distracting them from their children. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore the new challenges of parenting in the digital age and long-term effects of smartphones on children's development. We'll also ask parents and experts on ways to overcome digital parenting struggles. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
Welcome back. We are discussing the fighting in the Middle East. My guests are Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And in Cape Town, we have Sanusha Naidu, senior research associate with the Institute for Global Dialogue. Sanusha, in terms of what has just been said, Hussein has just mentioned that there are two sides here that seem to really want war. They want it to continue. But at the same time, there is the populations in all these countries. So what, in your assessment, is the international community doing or could do in order at least to be the advocate and the protector of those who are the, who are facing, the brunt of these fightings?
Well, I think, Vincent, that's the real challenge, because at the moment it's the people on the ground that are becoming the real victims, the real civilian casualties of this conflict, of this war. And I think what Hussein meant as off-ramps as well, we've seen this happen also in the context of off-ramps into the Horn of Africa, where these conflicts are also finding traction in terms of what's going on in Sudan, South Sudan, in terms of what's going on in the Horn of Africa. And I think we can't ignore the proxies and the actors in there. But I think what's really important for us to bear in mind is what the advocacy of international agencies and what central to this is the UN. And right now the UN is not seen, particularly in the case of Israel, as a legitimate actor. What I found very intriguing and disturbing was the fact that Israel has to basically vet those UN aid trucks that go into Gaza. And that in itself, I think, becomes quite disturbing in a sense where there's no trusted agency at the moment in the eyes of these those protagonists that basically can get the kind of aid into Gaza to help, not just in terms of food insecurity and the starvation and the malnutrition, but also in terms of the global health processes. And this then comes back to whether or not there's a respect for the SDGs and whether the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, will be achieved. And I think right now, where we are is really a blight on the humanitarian consciousness of the international actors.
So Hussein, you can respond to that also.
Well, totally
the question of confidence in the international organizations.
Sure. Well, I think it's fairly low because basically Israel controls all the important routes into Gaza, right? There's a small crossing controlled by Egypt that has been the one that's been most open, Rafah. But the only thing you can do there is load boxes onto trucks. That's not enough for 2.2 million people's basic humanitarian needs. The main crossing which can handle industrial loads of goods is Keren Shalom, and the Israelis have kept that mostly closed. They have allowed a trickle of aid in to indemnify themselves against the principal charge that backs up the accusation of genocide, which is the use of starvation, the use of food as a weapon of war. They were chided about this all the way back in March in the Joe Biden State of the Union address. He basically told them, don't do this. Don't use food as a weapon of war. But they really have been. If it weren't for four actors that have been crucial, there would have been a mass starvation event in Gaza instead of endemic food insecurity and one or a meal every one day or 2 days. The four actors are the UN and its agencies plus associated NGOs, including UNRWA is the most important agency that cares for Palestinian refugees. The second is two Gulf countries that have been giving money, the UAE especially, but also Qatar, as usual, gives money in Gaza. And finally, the U.S., which has pressured Israel at times, for example, to allow the polio vaccine when there was a polio epidemic, or to let in food. And now we see finally the U.S. is saying, if you don't let food in, if you stop trying to starve the people of northern Gaza, we're going to cut off your weapons resupply. It is, you could say, too little too late, but I would say it's about time, and it should be intensified.
Yes, and Sanusha, in Africa and in southern Africa, we have seen countries take sides. We've seen certain countries, you know, take sides depending on how they view this conflict. But also we know that there are bigger other interests. It's not only the sides in the war, but also their proxies and those who support them. How challenging is it for, say, the continent to speak in one voice, given the, you know, the divisions that exist in the world today?
Well, I think, you know, initially when you look at this situation, I think where you see yourself in the continent, particularly the countries, I think there's a general consensus that this is inhumane, this is unimaginable, and they basically kind of see this question being raised. I think just look at the latest UN Human Rights Council report, you're seeing a shift. But I think it's still not a big enough shift at times. I think there's still questions of how certain countries use the abstention vote within the UN to try and keep a balance or stay on the fence. But I think at the end of the day, there's also another dilemma within the African continent, and that is looking at Sudan and the famine and the hunger and the poverty and the conflict there, and how much of attention is that getting, and whether or not we're going to see a similar kind of push as we've seen in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. So Hussein, it's a year.
Yep.
The conflict looks like it's just expanding beyond Hamas regions and going to Hezbollah.
Yes. Yes.
So what could this do to the entire region if this war actually goes on and becomes wider?
We are potentially on the brink of something we've never had in the modern Middle East, which is a region-wide multi-front conflict. And that really would be a new thing. People talk about the earlier Arab-Israeli wars, it's not the same. So the nightmare scenario now would be Israel retaliates against Iran in a way that provokes the Iranians, because of domestic political pressure and other concerns, to escalate further. And then the Israelis strike something like Iran's oil facilities, attacking their economy, or more likely nuclear facilities, starting a large conflagration. Iran orders its proxies around the Middle East, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, the popular mobilization groups in Iraq, similar militias in Syria, everyone all at the same time to do their worst. And then you've got the Israelis, the Americans, some European forces, and some Arab forces there on the other side, and you could have people trading blows all over the region. And we're not that far away from it. It really, you know, it's a matter of a couple of decisions in West Jerusalem and Tehran, and we could be there. Right now, it looks like the Israelis are going to be restrained because of American pressure. That's a very good thing. Mm-hmm. But we're really, really close to a tipping point.
That is really terrifying. We
it
hope he
is
doesn't
terrifying.
Get there. Hope he doesn't get there.
Yeah.
Well, we have to leave it right here. Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Sanusha Naidu, senior research associate based at the Institute for Global Dialogue. Thank you both for the thought-provoking discussion.
Thank you. We appreciate your
time. Thanks to our affiliate stations for broadcasting Straight Talk Africa across the continent. And now be sure to check out our Straight Talk Africa on social media. Like us on Facebook, follow us on X, also watch us on YouTube, and let us know what you think. I'll see you next time.